It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
Let's delve into New Orleans, shall we? Most people are focused on what's going on in Washington, D.C., because that's what comes through the boob tube every day. But what really matters is happening in our cities, in our communities. And that's where you see the worst of the Democrat policies. That's where you see the worst corruption. That's where you see the real effects of their policies. In 1984, I was 13 years old. I would turn 14 that November. And my dad scrimped and saved for 2 years so that we could go to the upcoming 1984 World's Fair in New Orleans. It was coming to America, and it was going to be in New Orleans. And my brother was a senior in high school, or about, I can't remember if he would have graduated that year or already have graduated, but he didn't want to come on a family vacation. He was too cool for school at that point. You know how that is when they get to 18, they don't want to do anything with the family anymore. So me, my mom, and my dad, we set off. And we drove from Orange to New Orleans, which isn't that far, but it felt like a long way. We were going to another state, even though we lived like you could walk into the Louisiana border. We were going to a big vacation. We were excited. So we get to New Orleans. We go to the World's Fair, and my parents take me to the French Quarter, Bourbon Street, Iberville, and all the restaurants and the culture. And sure, you know, a fight could break out at any time. And sure, some guy might just vomit right in front of you. But this is one of those cities that it's like a Dickens novel, right? I mean, you just imagine lurking behind every corner. There could be a musician, that's true, or a magician, or a curandero, or a bartender, or a drunk, or a tryst. You don't know what's happening. It's something like out of a novel, right? Vanity Fair, or who knows what else. And I've always had this passion for New Orleans. You know, the music scene, the jazz scene, the food is phenomenal. And yet over the years, New Orleans has slowly but surely begun to change. And Katrina really exposed, laid bare, how awful the city's infrastructure was and the corruption in the city that led to such poverty. All those people who had to be rescued because they were living in squalor. And you saw the pictures of the Ninth Ward. It was ugly. But the politics fell into a steady decline and jumped off a cliff. You went from Morial to Ray Nagin, who's in prison, to Landrieu, who they thought would be better, I'm not sure he was, to now LaToya the Destroyer, LaToya Cantrell, race card LaToya. She claims racism at every turn. Her biggest project was a massive, massive monument that is a black hair pick, because she's a black woman. A couple weeks ago, you saw the story that she flies first class on the city dime, and she said it's dangerous for a black woman to fly in coach. Well, there we are again. It's all black, isn't it? Last week, New Orleans won the esteemed prize. They have now moved ahead of St. Louis as the murder capital of America. That means more murders per capita than any major city in America. Hoorah! The only good news, I guess, to come of it is a friend of mine recently was on the list to receive a liver transplant. And a thug was shot and killed in the Ninth Ward, and that liver was donated, and so my friend, who is a more productive member of society, has a new liver. So, hey, you know, one man's trash, another man's treasure. Well, this week we see the news story that LaToya the Destroyer has a foundation, a charity. Oh, yes. Yes, LaToya has a foundation, a charity. Isn't this wonderful? And it turns out that, like many of these occasions, that charity is, well, it appears to be her. There is a subpoena that has gone into the Foundation for Financial Records from the New Orleans Office of Inspector General. And the program is called Forward Together New Orleans, which, as it turns out, is the same name of LaToya Cantrell's inaugural committee fund. And now they say, oh, that $500,000 that went from that fund into this one, which she apparently has the ability to spend however she wants, which is not really a nonprofit. Well, that's just an accounting error. So sorry. Now that you've caught us, you're only catching us because we're black. So while the murder rate surge is worse than anywhere else in the country, as the infrastructure has fallen apart, the city has been engulfed in filth and corruption, and this wonderful group of people is having to watch as what they built for generations is being squandered. LaToya the Destroyer, it turns out, has been profiting off of quote-unquote donations into her foundation that it appears are being used for something other than charitable purposes. Cantrell signed in April a contract, two of them, to send almost $1.1 million in city money to the nonprofit, which is also known as the Mayor's Fund. She's literally taking city money, transferring it into her own nonprofit, which she alone controls. I mean, Hunter Biden is effectively doing that, but at least they're not doing it through a nonprofit. He at least has to claim there's some art. See, here's my art that you're paying for, Chinese CCP. I'm sure this is all just a coincidence. It can all be worked out. Nothing to see here. Move along. Everything's fine. New Orleans is back on track. Well, LaToya the Destroyer has issued a statement. And I'm sorry, New Orleans.
It's me, LaToya Cantrell, the mayor of New Orleans. I just wanted to clear some things up regarding my non-profitable organization called Forward Together New Orleans. And my inaugural fund also named Forward Together New Orleans. You see, I strongly believe that New Orleans needs to face forward and we need to do that together. We don't need none of y'all to be facing backwards now. No way, no how. I'm sure as hell ain't facing backwards. Ever since I was a little girl, people always said, girl, why you facing forward? That's just how my mama raised me. Can't help it. Thank you, Jesus. That's why I name everything I do Forward Together New Orleans for my mama. I heard no one complain when George Foreman named all his children George. Not once. Some people say that I'm crooked. They wrong. Some people say that I'm making myself rich. They wrong. Some people say that I'm a nightmare, but I'm here to tell you that I'm a mayor during the daytime too. Lord Jesus. I'm LaToya the Destroyer. Peace, y'all.
I'm walking to New Orleans.
Is the Michael Berry Show.
Presidential election years are easy to rally the base because you can rally the base around your presidential candidate versus their presidential candidate. But in between, the 2 years in between are called midterm elections. And in 1994, Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay managed to nationalize that election around figures and personalities and make that a referendum on Bill Clinton, even though he wasn't on the ballot. Well, this year we struggle to do that because we don't have somebody at the top of the ticket to say, let's rally around Trump. It's hard to do. So what I've tried to do is profile a few races that we need to win. And I'll tell you, for us, the people of Texas, we've got to win our governor's race. We've got to win the Harris County race. I live in Harris County, which is as big as most states. We got to win that because the crime's out of control. And we've got to get our attorney general reelected. And the left has thrown a very radical candidate against us. If you're not in Texas, you may think, why does what's happening there matter? Because this is a great example of exactly what's happening around the country. Very radical Marxist left-wing Democrats running against Republicans. The media is attacking the Republican. The Democrats are attacking the Republicans. The rich white liberals are attacking the Republicans. And they just sort of slide their candidate in there and don't want you to know how radical their agenda is. And then they get elected and you find out. That's what's happening in the attorney general's race in Texas. And even though our candidate, Ken Paxton, is leading, this is a way closer race than it needs to be. So we're going to talk to him now. A new poll just came out, says Governor Abbott is extending his lead over Beto O'Rourke. It says that Dan Patrick is extending his lead over his opponent. And it says that the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, has extended his lead over, as you will learn, a very radical Rochelle Garza. I mean, she'd be radical in California. I endorsed Ken Paxton in the Republican primary for Attorney General because he's done a very good job, because he has been at the tip of the spear. I don't endorse very often, as you know, especially in primaries, but he was being challenged for all the wrong reasons by all the wrong people. And it was important that when someone stands up, doesn't just quietly sit at their desk, when someone stands up and gets out there and takes on the controversial issues that we demand, which is why Donald Trump endorsed him as well, when someone does that, we need to keep them in the job and show them that we'll have their back. Remember Sharon, the woman that's been to 27 Trump rallies? She said, I don't have the money to help fund a campaign, but what I can do is be there and tell Donald Trump that I'm there for him and that what he's doing is a good job, and as long as he continues to do that, I'll be there to support him. And that's what I think we need to do for Ken Paxton. First, Attorney General Paxton, the great state of Texas, talk a little bit, you know, migrants, illegal aliens is what they are, coming out of Texas and being sent to D.C., Baltimore, New York, Chicago, now Martha's Vineyard and Kamala Harris's house. Even the ones that Ron DeSantis are sending are coming from Texas, because this problem has befallen more than anyone else, the state of Texas, where you are the attorney general. Talk a little bit about these flights. Are they legal to start with?
Oh, absolutely. This, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate what you said right before I got on. I really do. Yeah, they are absolutely legal. Look, we've got a huge problem here. These are sanctuary cities for the most part, Chicago, Washington, D.C. When President Trump was in office and he was limiting immigration and it was working, they came out and said, we want people to come here. We invite them to come here. We don't like what Donald Trump is doing. Send them our way. Well, Governor Abbott takes him up on that, and these other governors have followed suit, and they are delivering exactly what these people asked for. And shockingly, they actually don't really want them. They just said they wanted them. Now that they're getting just a few of them, they're complaining and calling Governor Abbott a racist and unchristian.
Unchristian. How very rich that they would say that. Talk for a moment, if you would, about Rochelle Garza, because I'll bet that 99.9% of our audience doesn't know who Democrat Rochelle Garza is, who is challenging you. I do. And much like Lena Hidalgo, who slipped in as Harris County judge and nobody knew, and then it turns out she's this left-wing radical, the prize of California and New York's worst, most radical politics, Rochelle Garza is even more radical than that. For folks who do not know who the Democrat challenger to you is, talk a little bit about her.
Well, first of all, I don't know of a more radical politician than my opponent. I think she would say that, and she's called Border Patrol, she's called them terrorists. She doesn't think there should be any type of restriction on illegal immigrants. She's represented illegal immigrants trying to get abortions, and she actually snuck a case through the federal courts to make us pay with taxpayer funds for a teenage illegal immigrant. She thinks we should fund all abortions, no matter who they are, whether they're legal or illegal. And she also believes that our election bills were passed by white supremacists, and that our legislature is racist and xenophobic for doing so.
You had a bruising primary. There were factions, some of them from outside the state, who came after you in much the same way they came after Trump. In fact, they're the same families and the same funders and the same mentality. And they came after you and attempted to defeat you in the primary, and the voters said, no, he's done a good job. How hard is it after that to then rally folks and say, hey, even if you weren't for our campaign, for whatever reason, we won fair and square, and now we have to beat this. How hard is it to rally folks behind you now and secure the team?
I would say for the most part, most people have rallied. There are certain groups that have that are typically supportive in for Republicans that have not been supportive. There's a group called Texas for Lawsuit Reform that fought me in the primary and still refuses to help me now. And that ends up being, damaging to our party. And at this point, it seems to me like people like that should jump aboard, given what we're talking about with my opponent. I mean, we disagree. My opponent and I disagree on every single issue. And it's not like, we're just a little off. We are as far apart as you could possibly be on almost any issue you can think about that would affect Texans.
Democrats show up and vote for their side no matter what. Republicans have a tendency to say, well, let me see if this person is completely perfect and if I've agreed with them on 100% of the issues all the time, and if at any point they wore a red tie when I wanted them to wear a blue tie or a blue tie when I wanted a red tie, let me see if there's any reason I could possibly not support them. And it's why people can't understand we should never lose elections if we would vote strategically. Our folks have to remember what you're up against. And if you weren't for Ken Paxton in the primary, the majority of people were. But if you weren't for Ken Paxton then, he is now your only choice to defeat the radical that wants to take over the attorney general's office. And that's a mistake we cannot afford to make.
No, absolutely. These races could be, we don't know, they could be 3 or 4%. And if we have 3 or 4% of the Republicans that say, well, no, I'm not happy that my person lost, even though we've got somebody that absolutely I would disagree with, and they would disagree with on every possible issue, they're just still upset about the primary. That doesn't make any sense. And I saw that when Trump ran. I saw people not voting for him because they didn't like him. I said, your choice is Hillary Clinton. You can't go wrong here. You're not going to do worse. You ought to at least give Donald Trump a chance, even if you don't really know what his actual views are. And I think this is the same way. Even if I'm not your favorite person, or Governor Abbott's not your favorite person, this is not the time to vote for the left-leaning guy or not vote at all.
Amen, amen, amen. I supported him in the primary. I am supporting him in the November election. And by golly, he's done a damn good job. He's not just the alternative to the crazy left-wing, left-coast California radical Rochelle Garza, who wants to put a Marxist in the attorney general's office. He's done a very good job. It's why he's been on this show a number of times, touting the efforts, the initiatives he has taken up. It's why Donald Trump endorsed him, and it's why I hope he will be reelected, because the state of Texas needs an attorney general like Ken Paxton, and that is Ken Paxton. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thank you. Have a great day. I appreciate it.
Michael Berry, known as the Czar, also known as El Tocino.
In the state of Texas, as you just heard, our border is not secure, and it is destroying towns and communities. It's awful. Yet the Biden administration tells us the border is secure. When the footage shows us, live streaming footage shows us, it's not. There's no way you could possibly say that with a straight face. Courtesy of the Free Beacon, here is a montage of 17 times the Biden administration has said this.
The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border.
The border is, in fact, secure.
A record 221,000 migrants crossed into the U.S. last month.
Our border is secure. We believe certainly that the border is secure.
1,300 migrants a day.
We have taken unprecedented action over the past year and a half to secure our border and rebuild a safer and orderly process system.
This year is on pace to be the deadliest year for migrants crossing into this region of Texas in recent memory.
The border is secure. The border is secure, and the border is not open.
Crossings are still at an all-time high, with Border Patrol reporting more than 1.8 million apprehensions from October 2021 through July.
The border remains closed. It is not open. We are turning away the majority of adults. But
the border is secure. The border is closed.
So we are offering solutions. That's what the Biden-Harris administration has been doing since day one.
This is worse now than it was before.
A record number of migrants this year, and the total could surpass 2 million by the end of September.
We're certainly doing a lot more to secure the border.
We have a secure border.
And we have a process in place to manage migrants at the border.
A record surge of migrants in New York City.
Over 2 million illegal immigrants crossing the southern border, an all-time record.
The border is secure.
We agree that the border is secure.
They're gaslighting. They just keep saying it because their hope is there are enough low information dummies that will say border secure. How do you say that? Well, that's how president, that's how. You know, I thought of this the other day, and this is a perfect time to play it for you. I go back and listen to moments in history, presidential speeches, news accounts, so that we can see what people were thinking at that time. And it was a speech that I remembered of Ronald Reagan. And he's talking about the Soviet Union and East Berlin. You know, I remember the wall falling. I remember that wall separating people from East and West Berlin, communism from the free world. And the people on the communist side wanted out. They wanted the freedom to come into the free world and live their lives. You see, the Soviets, the East Germans, had to keep them walled in because things were so bad they wanted out. In this country, things are so good here, we have to keep them walled out because they're coming here to destroy it. But back to Reagan's speech, the thrust of it was warning about the dangers of appeasement. We're not dealing with East Berlin and the Berlin Wall anymore, but I want you to listen to this speech, and I want you to take the lessons he's applying because they're timeless, and in your mind's eye, I want you to apply them to the violent crime we're seeing day in and day out. And I want you to think about the crisis at the border. Think about it like that. We don't have to live with this. We can vote out the Democrats.
Those who would trade our freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state have told us they have a utopian solution, a peace without victory. They call their policy accommodation. And they say if we'll only avoid any direct confrontation with the enemy, he'll forget his evil ways and learn to love us. All who oppose them are indicted as warmongers. They say we offer simple answers to complex problems. Well, perhaps there is a simple answer. Not an easy answer, but simple. If you and I have the courage to tell our elected officials that we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right, we cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters. Alexander Hamilton said, a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Now let's set the record straight. There's no argument over the choice between peace and war, but there's only one guaranteed way you can have peace, and you can have it in the next second. Surrender. Admittedly, there's a risk in any course we follow other than this, but every lesson...
This is news.
This is the specter our well-meaning liberal friends refuse to face, that their policy of accommodation is appeasement. And it gives no choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender. If we continue to accommodate, continue to back and retreat, eventually we have to face the final demand, the ultimatum. And what then? Well, Nikita Khrushchev has told his people he knows what our answer will be. He has told them that we are retreating under the pressure of the Cold War, and someday, when the time comes to deliver the final ultimatum, our surrender will be voluntary, because by that time, we will have been weakened from within spiritually, morally, and economically. He believes this because from our side he's heard voices pleading for peace at any price, or better rev than death, or as one commentator put it, he'd rather live on his knees than die on his feet. And therein lies the road to war, because those voices don't speak for the rest of us. You and I know And do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance. And this is the meaning in the phrase of Barry Goldwater, peace through strength. Winston Churchill said the destiny of man is not measured by material computations. When great forces are on the move in the world, we learn we're spirits, not animals. And he said there's something going on in time and space and beyond time and space, which, whether we like it or not, spells duty. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
With his finger on the pulse, the King of Ding continues on The Michael Barry Show.
Get to whether the pandemic is or isn't over and why that is important to this election, I must remind you, it was 15 years ago today, Oklahoma State University head coach Mike Gundy, he is still the head coach, Mike Gundy was being asked a question about one of his players, and Mike Gundy did what a coach should do. He defended his player against a media that was trying to make a story without regard for the human beings who were playing the game. And he made a point that I think was very, very prescient. He said, if you want to attack me, the coach, I'm 40 years old. I'm a grown man. You attack me. But these are kids. Now, I know these same age kids are fighting in wars. And you know what? They're still kids, too. They're young men. And I'll tell you, at 51 years old, I didn't understand that at 18, 19, 20, 21, I wasn't nearly as smart as I thought I was. Oh, I was good in class, but I didn't have wisdom yet. I didn't know how to confront adversity yet. That's why we have to send young men into war. Because as you age, your willingness to risk your life reduces dramatically. Dramatically. Anyway, it was 15 years ago today. And for those of you, I don't really watch much sports anymore. But back then, I sure did. And wasn't this a hell of a moment?
Anybody hasn't read this article, I don't read it. This was brought to me by a mother of children. I think this is worth reading. Let me tell you why I'm talking about this article. Three-fourths of this is inaccurate. It's fiction. Here's all that kid did. He goes to class. He's respectful to the media. He's respectful to the public. And he's a good kid. And he's not a professional athlete. And he doesn't deserve to be kicked when he's down. That's why I don't read the newspaper. Because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage. Come after me. I'm a man. I'm 40. I'm not a kid. Write something about me. Or our coaches. That's all I got to say. Makes me want to puke.
You think about it. That's what Trump did. He didn't let the press push him around. He stood up and said, you're not going to talk to me that way. I'm going to fight back. Because guess what? The public hates the media, and the media hates that fact. You ever been to a Trump rally? I hadn't been to 27 like Sharon, but I've been to a few. And every time Trump, at some point, they'll have the media about 150 feet from him in the back up on risers where they have good angles. And they want to get the crowd in front of him, and you know they're going to make them all seem like fire-breathing goobers. And at some point, Trump will always say, yeah, these people, they don't like me, but do you like them? And the crowd will boo and hiss them. And you can tell the media hates it because you remember at the end of, was it Catch-22? Yarian? He's being released after having been tortured for all those years. And they said, there's only one more requirement. And they said, what is that? And he said, what is that? And they said, you must like us. It's not enough that they do what they do. They desperately want you to like them. Remember on 60 Minutes, Joe Biden said the pandemic is over.
Mr. President, first Detroit auto show in 3 years.
Yeah.
Is the pandemic over?
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. And so I think it's changing, and I think this is a perfect example.
See, if the pandemic is over, then they won't be able to do mail-in voting. They won't have all the powers. Well, hold up. His press secretary, who's not the president, said, oh, the president was wrong. He was just a little distracted when he said that.
Also in the 60 Minutes interview said that the pandemic is over. There's been quite a bit of pushback to that statement by the president. Where is he today on that?
So just to step back for a second, what we saw during that interview, 60 Minute interview, when he made those comments, he was walking through the Detroit car show, the halls of the Detroit car show, and he was looking around. We have to remember the last time that they had held that event was 3 years ago. Even as we're talking about UNGA, the president's going to speak shortly, as I just mentioned, that hasn't been held in person for about 3 years as well. So we are in a different time. He's been very consistent about that. And the reason why is because we are now prepared. We are now ready. We know how to deal with this pandemic. It is now more manageable. It's not as disruptive as it's been in the prior years. And it is because of what this president has done on day one. If you think about where we were when he walked in, 3,000 people were dying a day. That has come down 90%. You think about schools that were closed. Now schools are open. Think about businesses were closed. Now businesses are open. And it's because of the work that this administration has done. Now, what he has been very consistent about is that we have to continue to have a front foot on this so we have the funding so that we are ahead of this, of any other, you know, as we look at future vaccines and future treatments.
Is he 2 years old or 200? Was Methuselah distracted by the shiny new cars? Is that what that's their defense? That's what they're telling us? That's the president of the United States of America? I guess that's why they have finally established the Joe Biden Dementia Center.
Does your elderly loved one sometimes tell stories that don't make any sense?
This was the diving board area, and Corn Pop was a bad dude. And back in those days, you show how things have changed. One of the things you had to use, if you used pomade in your hair, you had to wear a bathing cap.
Do you have a senior citizen family member who sometimes says things that are inappropriate and racist?
You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent.
If your family member makes things up when they can't remember what really happened, call the Biden Dementia Center today.
Nelson Mandela walked out of prison. I had the great honor of being arrested with our UN ambassador on the streets of Soweto trying to get to see him on Robben Island.
Because if your loved one is giving out advice that is not only wrong, but downright unsafe, they may need professional help.
If you want to protect yourself, get a double-barrel shotgun. Put that double-barrel shotgun and fire two blasts outside the house.
Our doctors are standing by and ready to help your family member who may have forgotten what year it is.
If you agree with me, go to Joe 30330 and help me in this fight.
Or maybe they inaccurately believe they're related to Janet Reno.
My deceased son was the Attorney General of the United States.
So call the Joe Biden Dementia Center today, where we can help your elderly loved one cope with their confusion and frustration. Suffering from terminal mental illness is tough.
Chuck Graham, state senator, is here. Chuck, stand up. Chuck, come and see you. Oh, God love you. What am I talking about? I tell you what, you're making everybody else stand up, though, pal.
Operators are standing by.
Paid for by Michael Bloomberg for Obamacare death panels.
It's that time. Time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
I was sitting with a friend of mine about 6 weeks ago. And it was him and his wife and his adult kids, and I had just done a show about raising young men. And I said I was starting work on a book about raising young men, and I wanted to talk to different people around the country. So that night at dinner, and when I get off the air, I forget what I've just talked about. That night at dinner, my friend Marshall Williams said, hey, you were talking about raising men. And he's raised a son and has a daughter as well. And I said, man, that really spoke to me. And I said, well, I appreciate that. He said, you know, my brother is actually the director of a documentary called The Colonel's Playbook. Do you know about this? And I said, no. He said, it is amazing and it's right up your alley. So he told me all about it. And we have been going back and forth to put this together to have this interview. Whether you're raising a young man, have raised a young man, or raising a grandson, your child is raising a young man, I think this is something that everyone, because if we raise our boys better, we'll solve most of the problems in this country. I truly believe that. The first thing is to have a father in the home to raise a boy. The second thing is to raise them right. And where there's not a father, that the community pull together and fix this problem. You got to know how to do it. You got to know about tough love. You got to know about discipline. Well, the Lone Star Film Festival in Fort Worth just accepted The Colonel's Playbook for their opening night to kick off the festival on November 10th at 6:30 p.m. for those of you listening in Dallas. What is or who is the Colonel and what is The Colonel's Playbook? Tim Williams, tell us about it.
Well, Michael, thank you. It's great to be on your show. And I'm super excited about this idea of The Colonel's Playbook, but also who the Colonel was. And it really, it starts off with the experience that I had when a battle-scarred Marine colonel basically showed up as my coach, and basically how it changed the educational experience that I had. I was 11 years old. It's in middle school. And it's also about the effects that it continues to have on my life. So I'm so glad that you've got this topic on your heart because it's been on my heart for a long time. I've raised four kids, and I'm so proud of them, and so much of what went into their raising, and I think the same with you were talking about Marshall, has gone into his kids, and the benefits are just unbelievable. So anyway, you know, here we are today in 2022. Kids, I think, are scared and confused. And basically, I am, you know, in a lot of ways, too, because you turn on any TV or read a paper or social media, and you quickly find out that we live in an unstable world, which I think leads to fear for them, especially for these kids, especially what the future holds. So I believe that the movie I'm producing, which is another, it's basically the offshoot of the documentary, Colonel's Playbook. It's called The Colonel, has the potential to inspire, I think, confidence in millions of people's lives. How do I know that? Because that's what the real Colonel did for me when I was a scared 11-year-old kid. It was in the late 60s. At the early 70s, at the height of the counterculture stuff that was going on, Vietnam War. I mean, it was huge upheaval stuff. And it was not that different from today. Plus, we were in a nuclear arms race. You remember, you know, the Soviet Union and impending doom. I mean, it was just like, you know, constantly on your mind. Another reason I think that the Colonel may be arriving at the right time, a couple of years ago, I made a 20-minute short of the Colonel, which I've kind of kept as, I haven't released it, but the past few months on YouTube, the trailer for The Colonel had more than 1.25 million views. And I've asked folks in film and television marketing, I say, you know, okay, this thing's done. It's, you know, had all these views. Why? And they say, well, it's basically insane. A trailer for a short film that nobody's seen does not get 1 million views. But if you read the comments that people have basically left on that site, YouTube, you can go to it, Colonel's Trailer, people around the world are starving for stories about strong, honest leaders. And so I'll set the stage quick for what happened. The year was 1969, and the school was Fort Worth Country Day. It was a struggling prep school, 5 years since it opened its doors. And even though we were academically strong, we were a joke in all sports, especially football. I mean, if we wanted to win, we had to find, like, YMCA teams to play. It was ridiculous. So here comes this war scarred Marine who'd been to hell and back fighting World War II and Korea, showing up as my middle school football coach. So I guess if you kind of imagine having Clint Eastwood or John Wayne at their peak walk into your locker room, only Lieutenant Colonel R.C. Rocky Rosker was the real deal. Was I scared? Hell yes, I was. But I was also thrilled. It was like getting hand-to-hand combat lessons from Conor McGregor or, you know, some Spartan warrior like Leonidas or something. The Colonel was a stud. I mean, he was built like a rock. He had a gaze that could cut through diamonds. But he also had a positivity that gave you chills and the feeling you could do the impossible. The main thing Colonel emphasized over and over was confronting your fear so you could develop beyond your limits. So how did he do it? Well, he used some sort of insight that he had combined with his Marine training and love for people to find the best in each person he coached. If you were a smart ass or a malcontent and needed tough love, you got it. If you were scared or shy or meek or, you know, you just couldn't quite get your act together, he motivated you with a different envelope. Because the colonel had a knack for discovering each person's goals, like their inner, you know, thing that they wanted to become, and he motivated them to new heights to move forward. And I think there's two quotes that sum up the colonel. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing.
That's right.
And then the other one is from the good book. It's Hebrews 12:11 that says, no discipline is pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it leads to a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. And I really think that kids, I mean, I understand why they feel lost. And I feel, and they feel like they're behind the eight ball these days, you know, because it really seems like there's so many forces that are determined to destabilize the world, like social media, politics, drugs, bullying, peer pressure. And, you know, it's kind of understandable why cynicism and fear have become the prevailing mindsets. One of the motivators in my telling the colonel story is that many kids believe there are no more heroes.
That's right.
Like
your hero might be your coach. Might be your teacher.
I know it.
Tim, I'm up against a break. This was your coach. You gave his eulogy. You later realized while you were in Iraq and shells were falling that this story needed to be told, and it's being told. Folks, go see it. It's thekernelmovie.com. Thekernelmovie.com. There is more to happen on this story. Young men need to see this. Moms and dads, sit down and watch this with your boys and talk about this. Talk about why we discipline. Explain what we're trying to raise them up to be. Thank you, Tim Williams. TheColonelMovie.com. Kirk Cameron of the famous Growing Pains.
Man, if it weren't for Growing Pains, I wouldn't be on the Michael Berry Show.
You have a role.
The Michael Berry Show.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away.
Several weeks ago, I got a press release about an organization that had been formed called Stop Houston Murders PAC, Political Action Committee. And it said Chuck Cook, treasurer, and attached to the press release that went to all media was a story about how with this upcoming election, Republicans, Democrats, independents, nonpartisans, citizens were banding together for maximum impact because the all-Democrat criminal court judiciary, there is one Republican now, Greg Abbott was able to appoint a replacement for a judge that stepped down, but basically up until very recently, you can say the entire judiciary, which means you can say it's the Democrats who've been doing this, have been releasing murderers to commit more murders. So I asked Brad Gloria, our Baron of Booking, to track down Chuck Cook and get him on the air. Who's behind this organization? Who are these people? Why are they doing this? I did not realize at the time that Chuck Cook was the son of the woman who was murdered last year, 80-year-old woman, as she's coming out of a CVS on a Saturday morning. Terrible story. So he and a lot of other people said, enough is enough. We're not going to stand for this any longer. We're not going to sit idly by and just pray the rosary and hope that the election turns out the way we hope it will. We're going to get involved. We're going to tell our stories. We're going to make people look us in the face and see what we're suffering through the loss of our loved ones needlessly. Well, that was the first spot. And here was the second spot that came out, and you may have heard it on these very airwaves.
My name is Lourdes Medina, and my mother was Martha Medina. She was a good woman and a good mother. And she was brutally murdered last year in a parking lot. Her accused killer had already been charged with capital murder. He was able to kill my mother because a Democrat judge had let him out on bail. I'm a Democrat myself, but life is more important than a political party. So I decided to do something. I joined Stop Houston Murders. These Democrat judges have created a revolving door that let even violent suspects out of jail and back on the streets. Their policies have led to the murder of nearly 200 innocent people, family, friends, and neighbors. We all pay the price for Democrat judges' deadly catch and release policies. So I'm asking you, please, restore law and order to our city. Vote out all Democrat judges.
Political ad paid for by Stop Houston Murders PAC. Chuck Cook, Treasurer.
Lourdes Medina is our guest. Lourdes?
Yes, hi.
First of all, thank you for being bold enough to step out from anonymity and step into the public eye. It's not easy to do for most people. And from what I've heard, based on a question I asked of some of the people who've been involved since you got involved, or since before you got involved, this was not easy for you to do.
Right? It's not.
Tell me, first of all, tell me what happened to your mother. Tell me about that day.
Well, it was, I believe it was a Thursday, September 23rd last year. She and I visited each other regularly, especially in the mornings for breakfast. And she wanted to come over
house. Lourdes, you had me there. What was breakfast?
Breakfast was for her. It was getting something from McDonald's. She loved their biscuits. She loved their coffee. She loved it very much. And I would sometimes cook something for breakfast here, but
like what?
She really liked McDonald's.
What would you cook?
Like it was her regular was a sausage biscuit with cheese and a small coffee.
Do y'all live together?
And she told me she. No, we didn't. I'm married. I have a now almost 3-year-old toddler, so I have my own house. But we lived 10 minutes away, maybe. Okay. That is the reason why we spent a lot of time together and really hung out a lot.
Was she by herself?
She lived with my father.
Oh, okay. All right.
When this happened, she was by herself. But she lived with my father. My father happened to be out of the country at that time that this tragedy happened.
Okay. All right. So on that day, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. On that day, she told me she was going to go by the bank real quick. She didn't tell me she was going to get off or anything. And then she told me, and then I'm going to go and grab some McDonald's and head over to your house. I told her it was fine. And I got up and everything, started getting my baby ready, my toddler. And I noticed she was taking a very long time, which was very unusual for her. She was always very punctual. She would tell you she was going to be there at a certain time, and she was there. And I just thought maybe she had gone behind with something at the bank or something, and decided to call her to let her know, hey, forget about McDonald's. I'll cook something here for breakfast for both of us. But when I made that call, it wasn't her answering her cell phone at the other line. Who was an employee from McDonald's. I'm sorry, who was very distraught and stressed. I could tone her voice, and immediately, I mean, as soon as someone else answered that it wasn't her, I knew something was not right. And then this person, the employee, asked me, who are you? And I said, I told her my name, and I told her, she's like, are you her friend? Are you? I'm like, no, I'm her daughter. And that's when she told me, your mom, and I think she was distraught herself. She didn't even know how to tell me, and she just said, your mom. And I was like, what happened? What happened to my mom? It seemed like I couldn't get the words out fast enough from her. And she said, all she said was, he took her purse. And when she said that, I knew something very bad had gone wrong. And I said, how is she? Where is she? And she's like, she was ran over. In my mind, I thought, okay, she got ran over. Like, she didn't even say, I don't think she even said ran over. She just said she got hit by a car. In my mind, I thought, it's a McDonald's. I was like, how fast can a car go in a McDonald's? So I thought maybe she got hit, but it's not something, you know, that I should worry a lot. And I told her, and she said, don't worry, she's still alive. But they're taking her in an ambulance right now. So I got her to ask the paramedics, where were they going? And they told me the hospital, believe it was Bentop. So I hung up with her and I just told her to hold her cell phone. And I immediately got a hold of my brother and then my sister. And my brother just drove by my house, picked me up. We went directly to Bentop to look for her. When we got there, my sister was already there because she works close to Bentop. She was able to get there faster than we did. And when we got there, they pulled us, all three of us, in a room full of doctors. And in my mind, I still thought, and I remember thinking, why so many doctors? You know, but in my mind, I thought, well, maybe there's a surgery going on and there's been complications. And then they each presented themselves and they said, we have a chaplain here. And in my mind, it still didn't click. I guess I was like, a chaplain, why a chaplain? And then they started going over all the description of what had happened. They told us that my mom was in an ambulance and that by the time she arrived at the hospital, she already had a low pulse, and that they tried to do everything they could to save her. I mean, they couldn't do anything for her. It's been the hardest thing in my life to hear. My world just shattered. It broke. Bye.
Hold on just a moment, please. Stay right there, Lotus.
The Michael Berry Show.
Please clap. Please clap. Clap.
We were born before the wind. Lourdes Medina is our guest. Lourdes, I'll just let you pick up exactly where you left off.
Oh, thank you. As I was saying, we got the news at the hospital and it was just unbelievable. I remember I stayed quiet. It's like my mind was trying to accept what I had just heard. I think I was in shock. I remember my sister started crying, and I think my brother was the same as I was because we were both quiet. And they asked us if we wanted to be alone, and we said yes. And I remember standing in that room with my other two siblings and just trying to figure out what we had just heard. Like, we didn't know if we could not believe it. And then came, you know, then came, how are we going to tell our father? Because he was not here at that time, and he's diabetic. So he has that health issue to deal with. And we wanted to figure out how to bring him back from, at that time he was in Mexico, how to bring him back from Mexico by himself. We didn't want this to cause anything bad in his health. So we tried to figure out who to tell first, how to do it. And I remember my brother called my cousins in Mexico and broke the news to them. They too, of course, could not believe it. I mean, it was just so unexpected. And they helped us to figure out how to get my dad in a system of transportation, a bus, to come back to Houston. We brought him with a big lie, and we had to tell him that she had been robbed, that they took her purse, and that she got hit by a car, but that she was still alive. We had to say that. Otherwise, we didn't know how he was going to react and, you know, refer his blood sugar not to spike. So that's how he came back. He came back thinking that she was still alive and that she was only in the hospital having complications. So he was calling us on his way home every so often. How's your mother doing? How's your mother doing? And we kept continuing and telling lies because that was the only way to make sure that he got here safe. So when he finally did get here, we all went to pick him up. And I think that right there immediately was a sign to him that something wasn't right, because it was not our norm for all of us to go pick him up whenever he came back from somewhere else. It was just usually one of us. So he said, wow, that's a miracle. All of you guys are here. Like, what's going on? And we just said, nothing. You know, we just wanted to come and be all here for you. And then he's like, well, I want to go see your mother. That's the first thing he said. And that's when we had to break it down for him. And thank God my sister was smart enough to have a cope on her hand, because that's what we give him if his blood sugar goes down immediately. And he had to use it. And, you know, he was in disbelief and started crying. And he's like, how did this happen? And we had to retell the story of how it happened. We all drove back home to my parents' house. And that was the first time that I stepped into their house without her being there. And it felt horrible. It felt horrible. It was an emptiness and hollowness. And we went straight to her bedroom. And I remember we all hugged. My dad just plummeted to bed where she used to sleep. And then we all hugged and cried together. That was the first time that we all cried together for her. It's been very hard after that. You know, my aunts, I have two aunts that live in Mexico, her sisters, they were given the news too, because they both are elderly people. And they're older than her. So, we all in our heads, we always think, I guess that's just how usually it goes. And it's common sense to think that way, that the older are always going to go before us. Mm-hmm. It's not
that's
like
how
that.
It's supposed to be.
Sure. And that's how it's supposed to be. Exactly. And so it was a hard thing for them also. And they were able to come, thank God. And they were here with us for the viewing, for the funeral. And my father, I remember when it happened. It was a Thursday morning. It was around, I want to say 10:20. I'm sure it happened, because I still remember when I called, it was around 10:30. And we had that whole Thursday to ourselves to kind of try to absorb what had happened. But my father got back to Houston on the next day, I believe. So by that day, we were already getting contacted by the news. Our friends and family had found out. They were all coming to visit and give their condolences. So he really didn't have time to absorb all of this in. It was very, very hard those first weeks. I'm glad and thankful that we had so much support from friends and family. Everybody was so supportive. Everybody tried to show us that they were there for us. But I never, never thought I would lose my mother so soon and in this way. It was very unexpected, and I still live with it. I still suffer the consequences. It's very hard. It took a lot of months for me to accept that this had happened. Especially because I think from all three of us at that time that this happened, I guess I can say I was closer to her, because I'm right now a stay-at-home mom. And I was, me and her were visiting each other a lot, and she was spending time with her grandbaby.
Laura, this, hold with me for just a moment. I want to get to why you came to my attention, and that is because the man who killed your mother was out on bond for another capital murder case, and Lourdes Medina said enough, and she has come forward. We'll talk about that coming up.
You sheltered me from harm, kept me warm, kept me warm. You gave my life to me, set me free, set me free.
That awful moment. Look, we're all going to lose our parents at some point. That's just going to happen, and we know it. But we expect that to happen naturally. We don't want them murdered. And then, Laura, this, after you find out that Andrew Williams and his accomplice ran over your mother and killed her and left her there for her purse, of all things, that Andrew Williams was out on bond from another capital murder case when he did this. You're already emotionally distraught, but what goes through your mind at that moment?
Wow. So much rage, so much anger. I was so angry. All of us were. And I could not believe how someone was out on bond on capital murder. Like, how does that happen? That doesn't even make sense. It does not make sense in my head. So I wanted to know how that had happened. And we started informing ourselves. We started investigating who was behind all of this. And we learned who the judge was and why he and how he was out on bond. And we were enraged. We were angry. At that moment, I felt that I had to raise my voice because I honestly, before this happened with my mother, I did not know how much of a problem this was in our county. I was not aware. When this happened, I felt like my eyes were open to a huge problem that I did not know existed. And I knew that there was so many people like me in Harris County that were not aware of what was going on. So I felt like it was my duty, my responsibility, and honor to my mother to raise my voice, to tell my story so people could start to notice and hear what was going on in our county with all these judges, because it was not just a judge that let my mom out. I started hearing about other cases, and I was just thinking, how can this be happening? And someone is not saying something about it. How is it not more in the open? And after that, the crime continued. I think it has been escalating for the past year. It's like the daily bread for criminals. And that's when I decided to join this pack, StopHoustonMurders.com. I was drawn to them because they showed true empathy and concern for what was happening or for what's going on with all these judges letting criminals out on bond. And they had the same view that I did and the same interest. They basically want to get the message out to the public to let them know what's going on and that as citizens, we can do something about it. And that is through our vote. So when I knew about this pack and I realized that we had a common interest, I decided to join them and to use my story, to use my mother's story to get the word out there about what's going on. Because if anything, my mom was one of those persons that would not stay quiet. She was the kind of person to do and say the right things when they had to be said without being afraid. And not only because of that, but because I have a family and I still have family members too, of my mom's age, and I certainly do not want to go through this again. I don't want anybody else to go through this again. It's just crazy how this catch and release reform that Democrats are using, how in the world did they even think in the first place that that was going to work? And then just describe us as collateral victims. Like, really, that's what we are to you? To me, it's like unfortunately, we voted for you. We put you in that position. And I just feel like this like lately, criminals have more rights than citizens do. And we are the ones that pay taxes. And we are the ones that are doing the right thing. We're not out there trying to rob or kill anyone.
Lord, this, let me ask you a question.
They are. That is their job.
In your testimony that has now been broadcast across the radio and has received a lot of attention, you say, I'm a Democrat, but these Democrats are letting these killers out, and I care more about what's right than I do party. And so I'm asking you to vote out these Democrats. How hard was that for you to do and say?
Honestly, it wasn't hard. It wasn't hard. I did consider myself a Democrat for a very long time. Since this has happened, it has made me question my beliefs. It has made me question how much I know about the system, how much I really know about who I'm choosing and the leaders and everything. It hasn't been hard because I truly want a change. I want a change. I want strong leadership back in office. I want people and leaders that are not afraid to implement the right laws, to do the right thing, to keep all of us safe. I don't want leaders that are on the side of criminals being soft on them and thinking, oh, they deserve another chance. Oh, they deserve another opportunity. These criminals have shown over and over again, they're not interested in making a change. And these Democrats have already been in office for, 4 years. And what have they done for us? I mean, I started looking in all of it, and it doesn't look right. It wasn't hard for me to say that because I truly want a change. I want strong leadership back in our office, and I want Houston to be the way it was before all of this started happening. And like I said, that is the reason why I joined Stop Houston Murders, because I saw that as the common ground, that we all have the same interest.
Laura, we can't bring back your sweet mother, but maybe you can save somebody else's. Thank you for being willing to step forward and tell your story. Maybe something good can come out of this. That's my prayer. If you like the Michael Berry Show and podcast, please tell one friend. And if you're so inclined, write a nice review of our podcast. Comments, suggestions, questions, and interest in being a corporate sponsor and partner can be communicated directly to the show at our email address, michael@michaelberryshow.com, or simply by clicking on our website, michaelberryshow.com. The Michael Berry Show and podcast is produced by Ramon Robles, the King of Ding. Executive producer is Chad Nakanishi. Brad Gloria is the Baron of Booking for guests and provides voices. Jim Mudd is the creative director. Script writer, parody producer, and Lord of Laughter is Kenny Webster Jr., a.k.a. Producer Kenny. Voices, jingles, tomfoolery, and shenanigans are provided by Chance McLean. Director of research is Sandy Peterson. Listener and superfan contributions are appreciated and often incorporated into our production. Where possible, we give credit. Where not, we take all the credit for ourselves. God bless the memory of Rush Limbaugh. Long live Elvis. Be a simple man, like Lynyrd Skynyrd told you, and God bless America. Finally, if you know a veteran suffering from PTSD, call Camp Hope at 877-717-PTSD, and a combat veteran will answer the phone to provide free counseling.